everybody, to the Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and I woke up to today's headlines, which said, "Time to get serious, Brussels tells Britain." One lady who is very serious about the economic consequences of a hard Brexit is Monique Ibal, who is leading the National Institute of Economic and Social Research's work on the long-term impact of Brexit on the UK economy. Welcome to the show, Monique.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Monique, I've got another guest coming on the show. It's Patrick Minford from the Cardiff University Business School. I know you've knocked heads with him once or twice before, but he says Brexit's going to turbocharge our economy. Now, with the main thrust of your focus being on trade developments, would it be fair to say you disagree?
I think that it would not only be fair to say that I disagree, but it would be fair to say that the vast majority of my colleagues in the economics profession also disagree.
Okay, so you say the trade situation is worth going through in one of your recent blogs with a fine tooth comb, something the media is clearly not going to do. Before we get into the details of the trade agreement, why do you think it's not been covered properly in the media currently?
Well, I think I didn't want to take quite that much of a dig at the media. But that was written the day that the Minford piece came out on the BBC website. And I was really, like as many other economists, I was also quite surprised that that piece of work was reported on without really, initially at least, without any rebuttal, without any flanking evidence, without any context about the fact that the vast majority of the economics profession actually believes that leaving the single market will be harmful to trade.
Because Patrick said something around the lines of each house will be £5,000 better off than with a hard Brexit. Is that...
I don't want to try to unpick Professor Minford's precise numbers. Frankly, there isn't enough detail in what's been released to unpick it properly. So I wouldn't want to comment on any specific numbers, but I think it's quite clear that just asserting that Brexit is going to increase trade and household incomes is very much a minority position in the economics profession.
Sure. Well, we'll have Professor Minford on the podcast to put his point of view across. But one thing that he's getting at is a sort of unilateral free trade idea. So you drop all the barriers to trade. But you argue in your blog that it's dangerously simplistic. So can you explain why?
Sure. Look, at the heart of Minford's argument is that if we unilaterally drop all barriers to our imports, which is all that we can do, we can't drop barriers to our exports unilaterally, right? That depends on our trading partners. So all we can do is reduce all existing barriers to our imports. Now, first of all, it's not even really possible to do that because a lot of barriers to trade aren't unilateral by nature. They're multilateral, they're bilateral, because they depend on agreeing on certain standards or common rules about either the standards the products need to satisfy or the standards that firms need to satisfy.
Okay.
So you can unilaterally drop tariffs. And at the heart of Minford's argument is that if you did that, then you would be exposing UK firms to more competition, and that would drive prices down. Now, the difficulty with that argument is that competition does need to be fair. So within the single market, we have agreed on what kind of conditions firms need to fulfill. That is, what labor standards they need to uphold, what environmental standards they need to uphold, to make sure that all firms in the single market are competing on a level playing field. Let's just imagine that we were to let down all of our trade barriers, again, even if that were possible, with an emerging market, that doesn't have the kind of labor standards we have, that treats workers in ways that we actually find quite unacceptable, that doesn't allow for any paid holiday, any paid maternity leave, all these sorts of things, doesn't allow to recourse to employment tribunals. Well, that's not really fair to our own firms, right? We're saying, we expect you, UK firms, to hold to these standards, but we're going to put you up against firms that can undercut your prices because they treat their workers in ways that we wouldn't accept here.
Is it possible to keep some regulation, though, that would forbid those particular products coming into our market?
But that itself is exactly the kind of burdensome regulation and red tape that Professor Minford wants to do away with, right? And again, I think it really is important to emphasize that within the single market, we have had access to a market of 500 million consumers right on our doorstep, and 500 million of the most affluent consumers in the world right on our doorstep, and with a level playing field, without undercutting one another's labor standards and environmental standards. That's fair competition for our firms.
Yeah, you say you look at the key factors for good trade links, and we'll look at some of the evidence that I know you, some of the research you've done, some of the other research that's out there. But you say proximity, wealth, and size are three main factors. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. That's coming out of literally decades of economic research, and research that's not just based on theoretical models, as Professor Minford's work tends to be, but work that takes those theoretical models to the evidence, it takes them to the data, and it uses really serious statistical methods to analyze all that data. Now, what that really rather large body of academic evidence has found is that trade depends on something what we call gravity, right? A country pair will tend to trade more with one another the closer they are, and the geographical distance terms,
yep,
the bigger they are. That is, of course, the UK and France are going to have larger trade flows than Belgium and Luxembourg, simply because their economies are bigger.
Sure.
Yes? And how affluent they are. So two countries of equal size, but are a country pair of equal size, but that is an emerging market, they're going to have less trade and less income overall than a highly advanced country pair of the same size. Right? Now, all of that is not just common sense, that is actually borne out by the evidence. So one of the difficulties with some of the claims made about the benefits that we could have from trading with the rest of the world is it tends to neglect these important facts of gravity, particularly the facts about that distance matters and that affluence, that wealth and incomes matter. So, yes, the other countries that outside the single market with whom we could engage in trade, they're either poorer, smaller, or further away, or some combination of all those things than the other member states of the single market.
Yeah, this evidence that we've talked about there, dates from that sort of 1950s onwards. Now, I know you've looked at it closely. Are you happy with the validity of that? Do you feel is it all completely neutral and unbiased? Do you feel?
Well, look, I think that if you go back to the 50s, the evidence beginning in, or the theory beginning, the theory begins in the 50s, and the theory was if we form a trade agreement, then yes, some trade would be created, but the concern was that we would also be diverting trade away from countries with which we don't have a trade agreement, right? And in theory, that's a fair point. The issue is, though, that having looked really rather carefully at the evidence, I have not encountered a single piece of high-quality evidence, right? Evidence that satisfies methodological standards, that indicates that the trade diverted exceeds the trade created, right? And that's the sort of thing that sort of Professor Minford keeps arguing. He keeps arguing that there's this theoretical possibility, and indeed there's a theoretical possibility, but we have econometric methods, we have data. An awful lot of serious economists have looked at this and just haven't found that it's borne out by the evidence.
No, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you've looked at countries like Brazil, Russia, India, Indonesia, China, South Africa, USA, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. In no way you feel that they can make up the shortfall from leaving the European Union.
So it's not just my evidence. So again, there's a really quite a wealth of evidence. People have looked at one popular set of countries to look at are the OECD countries plus the major emerging markets. That's what I've done in my own work, and that's what several of my colleagues have also done. Other people, other researchers have looked at even larger data sets that include a larger group of less developed economies. Really, the results tend to be pretty similar. There are two branches of the literature that looks at the evidence on trade and trade agreements. One focuses on the impact of the increases in trade from joining trade agreements, and a second branch weighs the increases in trade against any of the possible trade diversion effects. What that second branch of the literature finds is that trade diversion is even less likely the larger the trade agreement, or the larger the market size you're joining when you join a trade agreement. Now, again, that plays in the EU's favour, in the single market's favour, because this is a very large trade agreement. The other thing that the literature in general seems to bear out is that very deep economic integration agreements are more powerful, or are associated with larger increases in trade than more superficial kinds of agreements that really only cut tariffs. Now, the EU is, by many standards, by many measures, including very recent study by the World Bank, the EU is the single market is the deepest trade agreement that we have. Yes? So this is a deep trade agreement. What do I mean by deep trade agreement? I mean it covers a lot of areas. It covers things like recognizing one another's professional qualifications. Right, so if I qualify as a doctor in Estonia, I can come to the UK and with some language tests and a few basic checks, it's quite easy to get my medical degree recognized.
Right? And vice versa.
And vice versa. And so similarly, if I'm a structural engineer and I would like to work abroad, or I would like to work on a project abroad, as long as it's in the single market, it's quite easy for those other single market countries to recognize my qualifications and to understand that actually structural engineers in the UK need to know roughly the same things to build safe buildings as they do in France and Germany. And those kinds of recognizing one another's professional standards, also opening up one another's public procurement markets, right, that as a UK firm, and I believe there are some UK firms who actually specialize in this, UK firms can go and bid on public contracts in other single market countries. That's huge, right? That's a really big, that opens up our markets to an awful lot of competition, right? Because firms from also the kind of competition that Professor Minford would like to open us up to, actually in many ways the single market has opened us up to.
Okay.
And particularly in services. So while Professor Minford's focus seems to often be on goods and tariffs, actually the UK is a service economy, and more than half of our trade, more than half of our exports by value added, are actually in services. So the kind of deep services integration that the EU offers has been really quite beneficial to the UK.
And things like financial services, where we're seen as, you know, one of the biggest financial centres in the world, in London, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
So you say that we could potentially lose up to 30% of trade with a hard Brexit. And this sounds catastrophic. I mean, have you any predictions for what might happen? I mean, how would this affect us in real terms?
So, these are big, scary numbers, right? But they are big, scary numbers that are quite consistent with what other studies have found. Of course, none of us have a crystal ball, right? This is what the data is telling us. I think it's important to emphasize that these are long-term effects. So we're not saying that from today, the day after a hard Brexit, trade will decrease by 20 to 30%. We're saying over time periods of 5, 10, possibly even 15 years, we would expect that kind of a decline in the trade that we do with the EU. Okay? Now, the other thing is that it's incredibly rare that a country leaves a trade agreement, right? Trade agreements are very, very stable, mainly because they're mutually beneficial, right? When you start economics at university, the first thing you learn is what is an equilibrium? An equilibrium is a resting, stable state. And it's resting and stable because both parties or all parties involved are doing really very well out of the deal, right? So the fact that we see so few trade agreements break up is perhaps also indicative of their stability and the fact that they do quite good things. But I digress. The problem is, because it's so rare that a trade agreement breaks up, we don't really have much experience.
I was going to ask about precedent. Have we got a precedent for this ever?
Not really. And so sometimes trade agreements or trading blocs have broken up, but they tend to break up due to civil wars, due to really large political upheavals like the breakup of the Soviet Union, right? Or decolonialization, where, say, previous colonies then stop having preferential agreements with their previous colonial masters. Now, those, for a variety of reasons, those examples don't really fit to the UK leaving the single market. So what we're doing is we're able to measure how much of an increase in trade can we attribute reasonably to single market membership. And what we're assuming is that if we left the single market, that increase in trade would eventually disappear. Right? Now, it's very hard to say, mm-hmm. right, whether that works in the other direction, right? It could be that those losses are somewhat lower. They could even be somewhat greater. So we really don't know.
But you don't see it being positive?
No.
And you've,
no.
You have looked at short-term and long-term forecasts, what happens if we leave. We've mm-hmm. done a couple of papers on those. And the difference is that the longer the term, the worse it gets. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, in terms of the losses to trade in the EU, with the EU, yes, the further out the horizon, the longer these effects have, you know, the longer we and our trading partners have to adjust. Now, that is, again, of course, a double-edged sword. Yes, the longer the horizon, the more likely it is that the full losses are to have manifested themselves. But one of the things we also know about the UK is that we are a very flexible economy, right? So I think it's reasonable to assume that the UK will make up some of those losses by adjusting, by finding new niches, right? Currently, some of our biggest export sectors are sectors which depend on the kind of regulatory approval that we get as a single market member, right? We have financial services passporting. Our banks located in the city can do business all across the single market. And that has, I think it's uncontroversial to assert that that has benefited the financial markets and the financial services sector in the UK. Perhaps we will be able to find other kinds of niches that don't rely on trade agreements, that don't rely on regulatory access. But one of the challenges in thinking of what those niches could be is that many of them are related to technology and research and development. So one of the comparisons I like to make is to actually, perhaps a bit out of the box, but to Israel. So Israel is a country which is surrounded by its nearest neighbors, who many of whom, for non-economic reasons, don't wish to engage in trade with it. Also, Israel isn't endowed with single market membership. It has some good to decent trade agreements, but it's not that they're not equal to the single market. Israel has managed to find a niche in high technology, right? Because trade in these kind of high-tech patents and technologies is actually quite unencumbered, right, by distance and tariffs. And I'm saying distance quite carefully because that's evidence that I don't think anyone's ever looked at properly. But the difficulty with that is, so if we were to try and emulate that, is that in order to do that, we would either need to be very open to high-skilled migration, to talent from a rather large geographic area, as we are now in the single market, or we would need to really make a much more concerted effort to cultivate homegrown tech talent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, yes, it's possible that the UK adjusts. I don't think that any adjustment we make is going to make up for all the disadvantages of leaving the single market. But in order to make up for at least some of that, we're going to have to think hard about, A, whether leaving the single market doesn't actually make it just as even more challenging to fill those niches, because recruiting from, you know, seamless or, let's say, red tape-free recruiting of talent from across the EU is going to be more difficult. And we need to then think about what is our own education system doing.
Hmm. It's kind of fascinating to hear you talk about technology there. From a trading perspective and phasing out of the EU now, and Labour have come out and say they'd like to stay in the single market, is it possible to have Brexit and still be in the single market?
Look, I think that I'm not an expert on international law, but people who are, I think, tend to say, I think it's fair to characterize their views on international law as it's all negotiated anyway. So it is clearly possible to be a member of the single market and not a member of the EU. We have examples of that. We have Norway and we have Iceland, and I believe Liechtenstein.
Mm-hmm.
We have Switzerland, which is, although not a single market member, which has very deep trade agreements. That said, Switzerland's arrangements would not be ideal for the UK, because they don't involve financial services passporting. Right? The only financial services, to my knowledge, that have free access to the EU markets are direct insurance, so non-life insurance, things like auto insurance.
From Switzerland.
Or, yes.
Yeah.
So that would not be, in that way, Switzerland is not an ideal template.
And none of these nations were in the European Union and then stepped out of it.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, certainly with Norway and Switzerland. Norway and Switzerland were considering EU membership, and I believe in both cases there were referenda that failed. Now, the Swiss case of having very close trade links but not single market membership, that is not a terribly popular arrangement with the European Commission and with other EU members, mainly because there seems to be a problem with a lack of a supranational body something like the ECJ, that can arbitrate when there are disputes. Right? What you don't want to get into is a situation in which you have a trade agreement with your partner, and then that trade agreement says, yes, you know, we're going to harmonize our medical education standards. Mm. And then you say to your trading partner, but you haven't. And then your trading partner says, oh, yes, but we have. And then who resolves that dispute, right? So there's a tension between the kind of non-single market arrangement that Switzerland has and being outside the jurisdiction of the ECJ.
Which is a tension that Britain's going to have on many levels with the ECJ when we want to. And that kind of brings me on to one of my final questions, which is, whilst trade, which I think you've outlined very eloquently in this podcast, clearly should be really high on a lot of people's agenda, it's clearly wasn't top of everybody's priority in terms of casting that vote in the EU referendum. So why do you think ultimately the majority of this country voted to leave?
Oh.
It's a big question, I appreciate that.
I think that's a very good question. This is really well outside my field of expertise. I'm not a political scientist. But I think there's an argument to be made that the Brexit vote might not have been expressing discontent specifically with the EU, and it might have been a broader kind of expression of discontent with economic standard and standards of living throughout the country. And I guess one of the things, if that's true, then I think that's very unfortunate, because there are an awful lot of things that could be done to improve living standards that don't involve leaving the EU. So one of the areas in which the UK doesn't do very well in sort of international comparisons is our housing market, right? You know, if we were to have a saner housing market, that might help the living standards of an awful lot of people, in particular younger generations who are really finding it difficult and challenging to buy a home or to afford to rent a decent home.
Hmm. Nissan was in the news again, actually, just this morning, so I wasn't going to cite that as a bit of an example. Nissan plant in Sunderland, 61% voted to leave, yet reports saying that, well, Theresa May is heading off to Japan now, and let's push ahead with great trade deals with Japan. Mm. Coming back on the other side is, you know, Nissan chief exec saying, well, we actually see Britain as a gateway to the rest of Europe. So this potentially jeopardises Nissan's business with the whole of Europe. And yet, how many? 7,000 people in Sunderland employed by Nissan. So they would not want to jeopardise that. So it feels like a complicated and perhaps confusing situation for a lot of people.
I think I would broadly agree with that. I think that I think there's perhaps been a lack of a discussion over the past three decades about the benefits of trade, yes? And perhaps also a lack of a discussion about the fact that although globalization in the whole is beneficial, that of course there are going to be winners and losers, and that attention does need to be paid to helping those affected by, say, increased competition from abroad.
Yeah.
That they adjust. And that means helping people to reskill and also supporting people in being able to move to where the new opportunities lie. And there, I do need to go back to our housing markets again, right? Mm. In many ways, we have a big productivity gap across between London and the southeast and most parts of the rest of the country. And that either means that it's quite difficult for the jobs to move out, right? That might speak to things like infrastructure, or it's difficult for people to move to where the high productivity jobs are. And that would tend to speak to things around commuting and housing. So there are things that we can do to help people adjust, right? And perhaps more of that needs to be done.
Hmm. Monique, thank you for joining us today on the podcast. Where can we, for those interested, where can they find out more about your research and you've got some research you're going to be announcing fairly soon?
Yes. So we, NICER does a large body of research. Among other, one of our key topics is Brexit. And you can find our research at www.niesr.ac.uk.
That's all for today, folks. The show's been brought to you by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Pohl, and the theme music by Kevin MacLeod. For all things Brexit podcasts, go to brexitpodcast.com, and we look forward to welcoming you to a future episode.